The Murder Shelf Book Club contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Listener discretion is advised.
When we reached the booking room, the door opened and we went inside. I secured the door behind us. The doors lock automatically, and because they are steel, they make a loud metallic slam noise when they close. When that happens, the prisoner we brought into jail knows that they are here to stay. I've had a lot of them tell me it's the worst noise they have ever heard. Byron, on the other hand, looked like he was comforted by the noise. From Murder on Elm Street, A True Story by Jeremy L. Lubertz. Welcome to the Murder Shelf Book Club podcast. I am your host, Jill. This is episode 84, The Deer Stand, part one of Murder on Elm Street, A True Story by Jeremy L. Lubertz. Before we dive in, let me wish you a happy St. Patrick's Day in advance. Shlán tshuva. I hope you and all your loved ones are doing well. I have an important announcement. You can find me on Podcast Row at CrimeCon 24 in Nashville, May 31st to June 2nd, 2024. You can save 10% on your CrimeCon badge using my code, one word, all lowercase letters, MurderShelf. I can't wait to see you, and I'm looking to set up some kind of meetup for us, so stay tuned as the schedule comes out, and May is coming fast. It's really starting to get exciting. We always begin our true crime book club with some deliciousness. Minnesota is known for Bundt cakes. Now, if you have a Nordic Ware Platinum Collection Anniversary Bundt pan, you have to use that to be authentic. I do not have one, but I have added it to my Christmas list. Now, this Minnesota pear Bundt cake couldn't be tastier or easier to make. You know I like easy. Canned sliced pears. You keep the syrup, white cake mix, couple egg whites, an egg, and confectioner's sugar. You drain the can, and you chop up the pears, putting them in a large bowl. You add the white cake mix, egg whites, the syrup, and an egg. You beat it, the batter becoming very meringue-like, and I zooped it up by adding in some sprinkles for some color, and bake for an hour. I think this would probably work with pineapple too, and I may try it next time. It's really this easy. You cool, pop it out of the pan, and dust with confectioner's sugar. This is a very light cake, very moist, perfect for a book club. And thank you, Taste of Home, for this recipe. I am pairing this with a Michaud Columbia Valley Sauvignon Blanc 2021 from my favorite wine club, Naked Wines. This is a bright wine, and it feels full in the mouth, light and crisp. You can taste fruit, pineapple, green apple, passion fruit, and there's also a slightly almond tang on the finish. But I thought it would really complement the simplicity of the pear Bundt cake. All right, so now I'm thinking of the scene from My Big Fat Greek Wedding when her family and his family are meeting. What is cake? Bundt? Bundt? It's a Bundt cake. Bundt cake? Bundt? It's a cake with a hole in it. If you have not seen that movie, just stop listening and actually see this movie. It is hilarious.
Yes.
All right. So the regular price of a bottle of this Sauvignon Blanc is $21, but when you join Naked Wines, it is $12.99, and you know how much I love savings. You can find the detailed recipe and information about the wine on my blog at www.murdershelfbookclub.com. So, let's sip and swirl. Bon appetit, murder bookies. Our latest true crime book obsession, thanks to all of you out there on Patreon, is Murder on Elm Street. From the title, I have to think of the Freddy Krueger horror series Nightmare on Elm Street, and this is a nightmare, but I really couldn't help that. Our author and chief investigator in this case, Jeremy Luberts, is a native son of Little Falls, a central Minnesotan town that boasts approximately 8,300 people, so it has that homey, small feel to it. He is a second-generation law enforcement officer who followed in his uncle's footsteps, first in patrol, then as a sergeant investigator, and later lead investigator with the Morris County Sheriff's Office. Now retired, Jeremy has ventured into writing about the Byron Smith case, and he posted this on Facebook, quote, "I've come to learn after becoming a nonfiction author, it's a love-hate relationship. It's no wonder why authors prefer to write novels instead," end quote. Ooh, he must have gotten some interesting feedback there. If you're not familiar with this case, it caused a huge national divide, some of which still endures to this day. And I anticipate that not all of us will agree on what went on here, but let's maintain our cohesive community and keep open minds as we delve into the Byron Smith case. So let us begin. That Friday, November 23rd, 2012, was the day after Thanksgiving. It was a cool 28 degrees, or negative 2 Celsius, with fresh fallen snow covering the landscape surrounding Little Falls. Families had gathered to celebrate the holiday, with the delectable aroma of turkey, mashed potatoes, and other carbs lingering. Little Falls is a quaint small town divided by the Mississippi River. Its claim to fame prior to these events was being the childhood home of Charles Lindbergh, the famed aviator who flew the Spirit of St. Louis from Long Island, New York, to Le Bourget Aerodrome, France, the first man to fly solo across the Atlantic back in 1927. 5 years later, the Lindberghs would again be splashed all over the world's newspapers when their 20-month-old son, Charles Lindbergh Jr., was kidnapped and found murdered. After years of investigation, a man was convicted and executed for this crime, which you may recall me covering in episode 39, Second Cast, Crime of the Century. Well, this Friday after Thanksgiving, just after lunchtime, Jeremy Luberts was enjoying his day off with wife Chrissy and 9-year-old daughter Haley. To say that Jeremy loves Christmas is a serious understatement. Christmas trees, mangers, stockings, ribbons, lights, reindeers, as far as the eye could see. He began listening to Christmas music in his patrol car right after Halloween. The Luberts were ready to enjoy 3 days of uninterrupted family time. Jeremy had worked the day shift on Thanksgiving, and he had reviewed a rash of burglaries and the usual small-town complaints. Truth was, there was not much criminal activity, and he'd been thrilled to have a quiet day. Chrissy, a registered nurse, worked the afternoon shift at the St. Cloud Hospital ER. Both were entirely devoted to helping others. But reality was about to reveal there is no pleasing everyone, and shortly they would be thrust into a period of unexpected, sharp contention, lasting a few years. Jeremy's cell phone went off, interrupting family time. Answering, it was Detective Dave Sherping, who told Jeremy that a man named William Bill Anderson had called, saying his neighbor, Byron Smith, had called him, requesting the name of an attorney. Well, recently, Byron Smith had had problems with his home being burglarized, and Bill Anderson suspected that there had been another break-in, and maybe Byron had shot the intruder. Weighing this information, Jeremy knew it wasn't unusual for police to receive calls exaggerating the situation, but he had a feeling there was more to this call than met the eye. Trusting his gut, he needed to go into work. And poof, went the day with the family. He told Dave he'd meet him at the office, and they'd go over to Smith's together. Telling Chrissy he had to go into work went over, quote, like a fart in church, end quote. He felt guilty about leaving, but recognized he didn't have much of a choice. Changing, he put on his pants, shirt, bulletproof vest, duty belt, boots, and headed out. Deputy Rick Madison joined Jeremy and Dave Sherping as they planned out how to approach Smith. Jeremy and Dave would drive up and make contact. Rick would follow, staying back, but close in case something went sideways. Jeremy stopped by Bill Anderson's, just two doors down from the Smith residence. The sheriff's car window was down, and Bill came over providing more details, saying that Byron had called multiple times inquiring about needing to get an attorney. He repeated the concern that people had been breaking into Byron's house. Jeremy asked if Byron had shot anyone, and Bill said he had not, which, whew, okay, that made Jeremy feel a little better, and they proceeded to Smith, who lived on Elm Street in a brick rambler-style home at the end of a long dirt driveway. Parking in front of the attached garage, there were no other vehicles in the driveway. Knocking, Byron Smith came to the door with Jeremy saying, quote, "I heard that something might have happened at your residence. Would it be okay if we came inside and talked with you?" End quote. Invited inside, they entered between the laundry room and kitchen. Quote, "In front of us was a long hallway that led to the bedrooms, a bathroom, and a living room. Just off the kitchen, there was a stairwell that led to the basement." End quote. Byron then asked them to follow him. There was something in his bedroom he had to show them. And going there, they saw a window had been broken from the outside, and it was very cold in the room. Byron explained that he'd had another break-in. Someone had hit the window with an elbow or something. Jeremy breathed a sigh of relief that this was just a burglary report. Back in the kitchen, Byron told the deputies he'd heard someone trying doorknobs and then walking about on the deck. Then he'd heard the window break and footsteps down the hallway from where he sat down in the basement. Clearly nervous, Byron led them down into the basement. As Jeremy and Dave descended the stairs, they saw, wait, was that blood? The small hairs rising on their neck. Jeremy saw a brownish-red lazy boy set up oddly between two bookshelves. From sitting there, the only view one would have was of the stairwell. Jeremy noted that a pair of sneakers were sitting under the chair, as Byron proceeded to tell them that he had been sitting in the chair when he heard the break-in. Quote, "Then I heard footsteps start coming down the stairwell. As the male party got down the stairwell to where I could see his hips, I opened fire with my mini 14 rifle. I had it loaded and sitting next to me. The male party fell down the stairs after being shot and landed at the bottom. I then walked over to the male party and I shot him until he was dead." End quote. All right, reading this, I had a huge lump in my throat. And Jeremy was shocked at what Byron was telling him, while Dave's face registered, "Holy shit." Byron Smith continued the story. After shooting the male, he placed the body on a tarp and moved this into his office. Flabbergasted, Jeremy thought, why the hell would he do something like this? Byron said he sat back down in his chair. Soon, he heard more footsteps coming down. And again, as the person descended, he shot her too. She fell down the stairs into the basement. And Byron went over, shooting her again with the mini 14 rifle, with the gun jamming. And she laughed at him. So he then pulled his 22 from his waistband, aimed at her heart, and shot her. Whoa! Whoa! He just pulled another gun out and shot her. He told Jeremy, quote, "I moved her body from the bottom of the steps back into my office work area and laid her next to the male party. I noticed that she was still breathing, gasping for breath. So I took my revolver and I placed it under her chin and pulled the trigger to finish her off. I can't stand to see animals or people suffer." End quote. As Byron spoke, he also acted this out, using his hand and finger as the gun and barrel. And he put the barrel under his chin and demonstrated where he'd shot her. All right, now my face was registering, holy shit, just like Dave's had. Horrified at what he was seeing and hearing, he struggled to keep his face impassive as Jeremy thought, quote, "What kind of sick, twisted person does something like that, let alone standing there with a relative calm about himself as he tells me this?" End quote. Murder Bookies, I am telling you, I am recounting to you Byron Smith's exact words to Sergeant Investigator Jeremy Luberts that day. They are extremely important. I remember when this case happened, but I really didn't know any of the particulars. And it's very early reading, but I was really shocked at this blunt reveal. Smith further explained that the break-in and shooting occurred yesterday, on Thanksgiving, around noon. And now I thought, well, why on earth had Byron not called 911 immediately? And when asked this, Smith explained he hadn't wanted to disturb their families on Thanksgiving. So wait a minute. Again, Jeremy and I, and probably you two, were thinking the exact same thing. Quote, are you kidding me? No one gives a shit about bothering us or calling us regarding any little thing that bothers them, especially on the holidays. In fact, I wish he had called yesterday because then I was working. This was my day off, end quote. And Murder Bookies, this certainly isn't a little thing. Two people are dead. Well, Jeremy and Dave realized they hadn't seen any bodies yet, so maybe Byron was just delusional. Taking the officers to his office, found right to the right of the basement stairs, slowly turning the doorknob, Jeremy peered in, and his worst fears were realized. The bodies were inside. I have a diagram of this basement and some photos on my blog that'll help you visualize the entire crime scene. Partially wrapped in a green tarp were the young male and female teenagers lying next to each other. She wore a black hoodie, pulled tight, revealing only her eyes. Jeremy surmised that she probably had been trying to hide her face, which was frozen in a painful grimace. One shot had struck her in the upper arm, causing massive damage, likely from a high-powered rifle shot. She wore black gloves, likely to avoid leaving fingerprints, jeans, and gray shoes. The young male wore a brown camo coat, denim jeans, and was shoeless. Were those sneakers, under Byron's chair, his shoes? Peering under the tarp, Jeremy saw that he had been shot in the head near the right eye with a high-powered rifle, which did vast muscular and bone damage. Once seen, it cannot be unseen. Like many in law enforcement, Jeremy compartmentalizes such work-related images in his mental filing cabinet. And after 17 years, there were a lot of files. Question. Had Byron seen the male or female with a weapon? No, he had not. Jeremy now sized Smith up carefully as the deputy noticed blood smears and spatter on his shoes and jacket. Under Minnesota law, Byron Smith had the right to defend himself in his own home, and that includes using deadly force. What jarred Jeremy was these teenagers had no weapons, and they'd been shot over 24 hours ago, with Byron never calling the police to report it, which is incredibly odd. Instead, he called the neighbor. Smith also admitted to shooting the male while he was lying injured at the bottom of the stairs, executing him with a headshot when he was past being any kind of threat. He had done the same with the girl after claiming she had laughed at him, shooting her multiple times, ending with, as Smith had put it, quote, a good, clean finishing shot, end quote. He should have immediately called the authorities, reported what happened, and administered first aid, not acted as judge, jury, and executioner. In a gentle, soft voice, Jeremy explained that because Byron had been involved in a shooting, he had to place him under arrest. And Byron understood. He was only doing his job. On patting down Byron prior to transporting him, four shells of the Mini 14 rifle were discovered, and then four from his 22, with Smith confirming that they were the shells from the shooting. Heading out, Jeremy inquired as to where the guns were now, learning they were in a closet, and Jeremy confirmed this. Now, Deputy Madison was told to come to the scene. As protocol demanded in any death case, Jeremy called his boss, Sheriff Michael Wetzel, and filled him in. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension was also notified to respond to the scene. The BCA is a Minnesotan law enforcement agency that assists other state and local law enforcement with felony crimes, homicides, missing persons, sex trafficking, drug sales, possession, stuff like that. Their mobile crime lab is utilized to map the crime scene, collect and preserve evidence, everything from DNA, blood spatter, tire, shoe prints, weapons, as well as electronic devices like cell phones, etc. The BCA assists. It does not run an investigation, and Jeremy would work side by side with the BCA as this scene was processed. Crime scene photos came next, with Jeremy starting outside and then moving inward. Having testified many times before, he knew juries appreciated comprehensive photos as they could see for themselves the crime scene and through the investigator's eyes. Outside, he noticed that the property had security cameras facing the driveway, the upstairs entry door, and the upper deck along the back of the house and by that entrance. Taking photos of the cameras, he hoped that they were hooked up and working. He took photos of Byron's broken window in his bedroom, which appeared to have been chosen because trees obscured that side of the house, which would conceal anyone breaking in, and there was no security camera on that side either. Inside, he photographed the closet where the guns were stored, and down in the basement, he focused on the blood on the wall and the rug. The lazy boy, coffee table, sneakers, water bottles and energy bars near the chair, and the bookshelves on either side of it. The water and energy bars seemed to suggest that Byron was planning a long siege in the chair. He photographed the gun shells and then noticed, tucked back in the corner, a pair of jeans with blood on them. Now, why were they there? Was there another victim somewhere? He noted that the basement entry door was wooden and had been patched with a wood panel, as if someone had broken in before, with it being repaired. Then he had to photograph the bodies, a grim task as the dire stench of death was filling the office, his stomach lurching. Now, we've all heard it said, that haunting, distinctive scent of death is one you never forget. Jeremy writes, quote, "I have even tasted this odor hours and days after leaving a death scene. It appeared while eating my breakfast, lunch, and supper. The odor sticks in your body for days and sometimes weeks. I've inadvertently lost weight during these periods as I struggle to eat until the odor finally dissipates." End quote.
Oof.
There was a TV monitor and DVR set up in the back of the room where the outside security cameras could be monitored. Then Sheriff Wetzel arrived, with Jeremy catching him up to speed as Byron left en route to the sheriff's office. The Smith house was secured, and now it was an official crime scene. Jeremy wanted to conduct the interview with Byron, and to his surprise, he had to make his case for doing so to the sheriff. Ticked off, Jeremy said he'd developed a rapport with Smith. While he'd only been an investigator for 2 years, he had 15 years' experience in patrol, where he conducted numerous interviews. Plus, he'd aced his training and had been mentored by more experienced investigators. And he won his argument. Jeremy's approach is always to be upfront and honest when dealing with people. He treats suspects with kindness and respect, regardless of the crime, because he believes he has a far greater chance of cooperation and getting to the truth. His personal feelings about any crime or suspect are irrelevant. Now, Jeremy isn't some wide-eyed idealist either. When this isn't reciprocated, the kindness can evaporate. But he never had to go that route with Byron Smith. One thing I noticed reading Jeremy's book, that it is a thorough police primer. What we see on TV shows doesn't always translate from R-E-E-L to R-E-A-L. He explains police procedures, how to gain entry into a person's home, how to photograph the crime scene, how to conduct an interview, how search warrants are issued, and all the paperwork involved. Now, the thorniest part of an interview is always at the very beginning, getting past the Miranda warning. He explains where Miranda stems from, the 1966 Supreme Court case, and how it changed the constitutional rights of detained suspects. Now, Jeremy was concerned that after being Mirandized, Byron Smith might clam up. Hey, he had already asked Bill Anderson for help in finding him a lawyer. But because he had been respectful to Smith, His gut told him that Smith would trust him and talk. Inside the small interview room, you sat Byron Smith. Did Byron want a cup of coffee, water, maybe a pop, or soda, as I call it? Did he need to use the restroom? Jeremy didn't want any interruptions once they began, and he also conveyed his concern for Byron. He declined. After telling him that he was recording their conversation, they began at 2:59 p.m. Confirming his name, birth date, address on Elm Street, Jeremy got chills up his spine, recalling the carnage he's witnessed, Freddy Krueger crossing his mind. But he began by asking Smith if he knew why he was here. Smith referenced the bodies that they'd found. And then came the moment of truth, the Miranda warning. With Smith waiving his rights.
Whoa.
They reviewed the circumstance of his 12 calls between Byron and his neighbor Bill Anderson, and that all the lawyers he had contacted were off or busy. So remember, this is actually Black Friday. Interesting to me is that Byron called Bill 12 times, but never called 911 himself. Around 11:30 a.m., Byron asked Bill to call the sheriff's department. Bill Anderson was the only one that knew he was having trouble with break-ins, and he might do something. He might do something. Now, what did that mean? Byron reflected that he had had a problem with break-ins for the last 12 or 15 years. 3 weeks ago in October, Byron had left around 11:30 a.m. to go shopping in St. Cloud, about a 35-minute drive away, and returned around 6 p.m., finding that someone had kicked in his basement door and gained entry. Since it happened exactly when he was absent from his property, Byron thought he'd been surveilled, that someone knew his routine. The garage of an investment property adjacent to his house was burglarized the next day, the garage door busted open. Nothing of value was there, save for a tool bag, but the thieves had made a real mess of the place. Byron had reported this to Jamie, asking him to investigate the matter. Jamie? Well, he's another investigator, and we will get back to Jamie, I promise you, but we're going to deal with Byron's statement first. On Thanksgiving, Byron usually went to his neighbors, the Langs, but he felt uncomfortable going to other people's homes on the holiday, so yesterday he stayed home. He was down in the basement in his favorite reading chair, reading, and it is a very quiet house. He heard someone rattling the upstairs door. Alarmed, he saw a shadow pass the window, and then the basement door was rattling, but it was locked and deadbolted. Then he heard walking on the deck overhead, and the doors rattling there too. Now Byron was becoming seriously stressed, hoping that they would go away. He waited and waited, and then glass shattered. Byron now began explaining that his life had been unpleasant of late. He had been plagued by insomnia, worrying about being victimized again. He had begun carrying his guns with him inside because someone could break in at any time. And now it's happening. Sitting in the chair, Byron heard steps coming down the stairs, and he figured these are the same thieves who stole his guns. Quote, I figured they're willing to use guns if they steal guns, and I decided I've got a choice of either shooting or being shot at, which is sort of what I came to when I started carrying them with me. This past month, I felt very threatened inside my home. End quote. Figuring the person entered through the broken window, he saw the person on the stairs and shot him. He sat down again, feeling tingly with adrenaline, with his blood pounding in his ears, trying to calm down, and he heard more footfalls coming down the hallway and starting down the stairs. Byron said, quote, everybody has sore spots, and I've known since grade school that being ganged up on is a sore spot with me. I wasn't thinking. They're ganging up on me, so I killed her too. The same way, except the first shot, she tumbled, and I walked over to finish her off. End quote. After his guns had been stolen, Byron bought a new Mini 14 rifle as a replacement, and he used it for shooting muskrats and beavers. Shooting at this burglar, the rifle jammed, and she laughed at him, which was another trigger, with Byron pulling out his .22 and shooting again and again. He sat down and didn't do anything else for an hour. When asked some questions, he clarified to Jeremy that he'd watched the intruder come straight down the stairs, and he saw feet, then legs, then hips, and he fired. Had he shot the male in the face with the .22 also? Byron wasn't sure, explaining his philosophy, quote, "I don't want to prolong the suffering, even if I kill somebody. I don't want to leave them to lay and suffer. In fact, with the female, after dragging her out of the way, she was still doing some faint gasping, and I just..." Wilberts interjects, "You're saying right there. You're pointing your finger underneath your chin?" Smith, "Up in the chin, into the cranium. The .22's a pea shooter. It doesn't go through bone very well." End quote. Oh my God, I think he's expecting Jeremy to approve him putting her out of her misery. But this is a person, not a sick animal. And I'm really trying to maintain an open mind as we get into this. But honestly, Byron Smith isn't making it easy for me. Jeremy went on to confirm Byron's earlier statements about shooting when he saw the male's hips. So I'm paraphrasing here. How many times had he shot? Byron thought once, maybe twice. Did the male have anything in his hands? Byron hadn't seen his hands at this point. Had he noticed what the male was wearing? Byron said jeans and a fancy belt. When he'd been shot, he tumbled down the stairs and his shoes came off, and Byron had kicked them under the reading chair. He checked the bottom tread pattern. Whoever had kicked in the basement door the previous time had left a tread pattern print behind, a sawtooth repeating pattern, characteristic of skateboard shoes. Jamie had it in evidence. Byron added, quote, "Very few people over 30 wear skateboard shoes," end quote. After confirming he had all the information correct, Jeremy moved on. After he'd fallen down, Smith said the male was looking up at him, and with his Mini 14, quote, "I shot him in the face. I want him dead," end quote. Smith said there was a lot of blood, so he grabbed a tarp he uses to cover firewood and pulled him onto it so he wouldn't get blood on his carpet. Then he pulled him over to the shop area where Jeremy saw him lying earlier. Luberts asked when the female party had come in, and Smith replied, quote, I said 2 to 5 minutes later, since I was just sitting there stunned. That's the best estimation I can give," end quote. Then Byron got up from his reading chair. The first shot went off when she was at hip height, causing her to fall down the stairs. He only shot her once because that's when his gun jammed. Like before, he had not seen her hands before the first shot. Byron said that he hadn't asked her if she was armed because his guns had been stolen. He wasn't going to give them a chance to shoot him. And both of these burglars were unarmed. "Well, what happened after the misfire?" Jeremy asked. Byron continued. Lying at the foot of the stairs, she laughed at him, a short laugh because she was hurting. And this was another red button for him. If you shoot someone and they laugh at you, you go again. And yes, he'd fired more shots than he needed to. "Well, why had he done that?" Jeremy asked. "Well, the .22 he had is a pea shooter, and he was feeling very, very threatened." Jeremy asked if he came enraged when she left. No, not enraged, but mad. Byron believed she had been breaking into his home, and he wasn't going to take it anymore. He was no longer willing to live in fear. Jeremy listened carefully, judgment-free, and finally Smith admitted, quote, "I was far over the edge," end quote. He elaborated. He was reacting to the threat, the previous losses, and he was justified in doing what he did. Byron is a retired security engineer officer with the U.S. State Department. He now referred to his 20 years living abroad, a few years in Thailand, Egypt, sub-Saharan Africa, Russia, and China. In all that time, he had never been threatened, never had anything stolen. But retire, move back to his hometown, he gets robbed living in fear. He continued. After she laughed, he pulled his .22 from his waist holster, aiming at her heart, and he fired again and again and again, hitting her in the chest, and she stopped moving. He grabbed her by the clothes and dragged her onto the tarp and moved her into the office next to the male. Quote, "She was on the tarp and she was still gasping. And as much as I hate someone, I don't believe they deserve pain, so I gave her a shot under the chin up into the cranium, and she gave out the death twitch. End quote.
Wow.
Lubberts recapped again, making sure he understood what he was hearing. And Smith elaborated more. Quote, well, I didn't know how well I hit her. I mean, she was laying there looking at me. She could have gotten up for all I know. Lubberts, Byron, why did you shoot again? She didn't have a weapon in her hand. Smith, actually, I didn't know if she had a weapon in her hand until later. Lubberts, but she was laying there hurt. She wasn't threatening you. Smith, I thought she was threatening me. He had already determined that they were gun thieves and thus totally dangerous. End quote. He described what she was wearing, a tight black sweatshirt that said hard candy. Quote, she is well known throughout the community as a hard case. She had the drawstrings tight around her face to disguise any visual characteristics. End quote. And to thwart his security cameras. The thing is that Byron believes that this girl was his closest neighbor, Ashley Williams, who was rumored to have been seen wearing Byron's stolen camouflage jacket. Byron avoided her and her nasty family. Spoiler, this is not Ashley Williams that Byron shot. But he mused that it all could have gone to waste given she was so covered up and it probably wouldn't have stood up in court. He believed that she and the guy were working as a team, as she'd been rattling doorknobs too. Apparently, she expected him to let her in. Byron admitted that about an hour later he checked their pulses, but there were none. And the rest of that afternoon and evening, Byron was fearful of an accomplice. He discussed this with Bill, that the thieves probably had someone at the Williams house watching to see if Byron came home so he or she could warn them. He also considered that it was possible the parents were in on it too. But by noon today, nothing had happened, so he figured it was time to go get this over with, and he called Bill. Had he left the residence at any point from the incidents until the sheriff department arrival? No, quote, I was afraid to go upstairs because I thought there might be somebody with a gun looking in the windows, end quote. As the interview wrapped up, Jeremy explained that he had to collect the clothing Byron was wearing at the time of the shooting, other clothes being arranged for him. Byron told him that they would probably have blood on them. He also agreed to a DNA test. And the million-dollar question. Lubberts asked, quote, after the shooting was done, why didn't you call 911? Smith replied, for the first couple hours I was just shaking, and I gradually shifted from worrying about another accomplice. There had already been two, and I knew that both the brass-plated bitch and her husband were both watching. As far as I knew, the whole family was in on it, and I was pretty much afraid to do anything. An hour later, I had this screwball thought that seems sort of irrational now, but just because my Thanksgiving was screwed up, I don't need to screw up yours. I can wait until tomorrow in the light of day. End quote. Reviewing the interview with two BCA agents who had arrived, lead BCA agent Chad Musias wanted more information about Byron's stolen guns. Agreeing, Jeremy picked up a DNA kit and went back into the interview room. Now from Byron, they learned that an earlier break-in had occurred and they'd missed his guns. But the second time in October, they found two of them in the closet. The stainless steel Ruger Mini 14 was one that he had replaced, and the other gun was his father's shotgun, one he had used for 30 or 40 years. Byron had owned the 22 since 1975, and the thieves had missed it. Jeremy asked again for Byron's consent for a DNA test and was given the go-ahead. Afterward, Byron was returned to jail and secured by corrections officers. Byron told them, quote, I'm going to sleep much better tonight knowing that I will be safe, end quote. In the booking room, Jeremy sat down at the computer and began Byron's jail paperwork. The corrections officer asked what Smith's charges were, and Jeremy told him two counts of second-degree murder, with the officer laughing aloud. But Jeremy was not joking and repeated, two counts of second-degree murder, with the corrections officer blinking in shock. Since we are all savvy true crime aficionados, You may be wondering why the charges were not first-degree premeditated murder, because I sort of think they should be. Well, Jeremy addresses this, quote, "A person cannot be charged with first-degree murder until there's been a grand jury. The grand jury must decide whether there is enough probable cause for someone to be charged with first-degree murder," end quote. He really does a fabulous job of explaining the ins and outs of being an officer in this judicial system. While law enforcement does the booking charge, that may not actually be the crime that the defendant is prosecuted for. That is up to the county district attorney, who reviews the evidence and determines what the actual charges will be. They then do the criminal charging, not the police. So think of this as an estimate. Leaving booking, Jeremy felt better that Byron Smith was in custody. Then, dispatch shared that she'd received a phone call saying that two teenage cousins, Nicholas Brady and Haley Kiefer, had failed to show up for Thanksgiving dinner. The parents couldn't reach their cell phones, and no one had heard from them since yesterday. Jeremy's ears picked up hearing the name Nicholas Brady, who he'd become familiar with investigating thefts and burglaries. There was no evidence yet, but the name was on his radar. He did not know who Haley Kiefer was, but deeply suspected the missing kids were the teens from Smith's basement. News travels fast. State Patrol officer Ryan Bierce reached out to Morrison County. He had heard about the shooting and had information to share. Meeting with Patrol Sergeant Sean Larson, Bierce said that a 1995 gray Chevy 10 pickup truck had been parked in front of his residence on Oak Street since yesterday. The cul-de-sac is about a quarter of a mile, or 0.4 kilometers, from Byron's residence. Yesterday, on Thanksgiving, Brian's wife Carla, who is also a State Patrol officer, called telling him that the vehicle was still parked there. Sean had the pickup truck towed to the sheriff's impound garage. Chills ran down Jeremy's back as it immediately occurred to him that perhaps Byron Smith had deliberately parked there to make it appear he wasn't home. Was he so desperate to catch the thieves breaking in that he had set them up? Cold realization hit Jeremy as he connected the dots. Byron sat in his basement chair with energy bars and water. His statements, the boy's shoe treads, matched those left on the door panel from the previous break-in. He'd shot him in the face because he wanted him dead. He shot the girl after he claimed she laughed at him. He hadn't called law enforcement immediately. He now knew that Byron Smith planned to kill whoever broke into his house and parked the pickup truck away from his house deliberately, making it look like he wasn't home. It all made sense. My blood ran cold reading this. I was waiting for the facts to come together before coming to any conclusions, and I was certainly uneasy reading about Byron Smith's statements. This is really cold and calculated. I think this guy set up a trap. Jeremy then explains a popular Minnesotan hobby, deer hunting. Lots of deer hunters out there. Well, Jeremy Lubbers is a deer hunter. Hunters hide for hours in deer stands, on or off the ground, waiting for deer to wander over so they can shoot it. You don't want to be making noise getting in and out of a stand to fetch water and whatnot, so you make sure to have protein bars and water, because you're going to be there for a long time. After the kill, hunters drag the deer away from the scene, returning to the stand, resuming waiting for the next opportunity. Uh-huh, you see where we're going with this, huh? Byron Smith's deer stand was his basement reading chair, placed between the bookshelves to keep him hidden. His truck was parked away from the house to make it appear no one was home. He stocked energy bars and water so he could settle in for a long wait, waiting for the prey to arrive and break into his home. Meanwhile, he read a book and kept quiet until the prey came into sight, and then he made the kill. After killing the first one, he dragged the prey away from the scene, reloaded his gun, and sat back in his chair deer stand until the next one came by. And then he killed her, just like a deer. I had to stop reading a bit when I finished this page. It just was, It just hit me. Jeremy also learned of another suspicious vehicle parked one block east of Byron's driveway, a Mitsubishi Eclipse two-door hatchback with Minnesota plates that were registered to Jason Brady, who Jeremy knew was the father of Nicholas. They now believe that the unidentified deceased male was Nicholas, the female his cousin Haley. Nicholas had driven to Byron's residence. Haley had been the passenger, parking a block away so their car wasn't seen at Byron's. The Mitsubishi had been towed to the garage as Jeremy and Agent Chad Musias drafted the search warrants for the Eclipse, Smith's residence, his Chevy pickup, the attached two-stall garage, and the detached two-stall garage at Smith's property, and for his blood for further DNA analysis. The Honorable J. Carlson was the on-call judge who received the faxes that were sent over for his scrutiny. Reviewed and approved, Jeremy swore an oath separately for all five warrants, that all the information in the warrants were factual and accurate to the best of his knowledge. Warrants were signed and faxed back. With legal warrants in hand, Jeremy and his partner, Sergeant Investigator Jason Worley, went to the jail to take Byron to the hospital for the blood work. Agent Musias and his colleagues would be dispatched to Byron's house to start processing the crime scene. Meeting with Byron, Jeremy explained the next steps, that the search was being conducted, and that they'd be heading over to St. Gabriel's Hospital. He understood, and he was cooperative, sitting in the back of the squad car, handcuffed. 5 minutes later, they walked into the ER. Using the BCA blood kit provided, a registered nurse drew the blood. Byron was asked to initial the tags used to seal the vials of blood, and then he was transported back to jail, turned over to the corrections officers again. Jason and Jeremy then went over to Byron's residence to further assist with the search. The blood vials were turned over to the BCA's mobile crime lab, which was parked in Byron's driveway, assigning an evidence receipt to maintain the proper chain of command. I really do appreciate the details that Jeremy provides, because TV cop shows overlook this or make it feel ippity-pippity-poof done in seconds. Well, it is not. And of critical importance is maintaining the chain of evidence. It is the first thing a good defense attorney will examine and try to get the evidence thrown out. And it can happen if your paperwork does not line up with proper procedures. Defense attorneys can make an officer look incompetent, testifying that he or she did not do their jobs correctly, which is probably deserved if that's the case. After turning over his evidence, Jeremy was updated by the BCA agents. When they moved the blood-stained carpet, they found blood and brain dura from the shot to the head underneath it. Agent Musias concluded, quote, "It appears Byron must have put the rug over the blood and brain matter after shooting the boy to cover it up," end quote. Byron had covered his tracks like a good hunter before returning to his deer stand, and he did this to ensure that the girl would continue to come down the stairs looking for Nick, because if she'd seen a bloody mess, she would have run like hell, and she never would have become victim number two, and Byron could not have his revenge. And Byron had not mentioned that in his very detailed interview with Jeremy. With Nicholas Brady and Haley Kiefer now positively identified, they were placed in body bags and transported to the Ramsey County Medical Examiner to be autopsied. The medical examiner would determine cause of death, how many times the victims had been shot, and where, and which shots had likely been fatal. The bullets used and the type of weapons would be confirmed as well, with the BCA matching bullets to the shells to the rifle and the pistol. And the Brady and Kiefer families needed to be informed, always a grim task, that was carried out by Chaplain Greg Valentine. They were simply crushed, incredulous. It was just inconceivable that Nick and Haley could be involved with burglary. They had not been raised this way. The reaction of learning a loved one was dead always tore out Jeremy's heart. He writes that the memory of these notifications, quote, live with you forever. It's a burden that comes with being a law enforcement officer, these moments that we carry through our jobs and long after our careers are over, end quote. So how do officers like Jeremy cope? Well, they do their damnedest to bring justice to the person who caused the death and anguish. Having a strong faith in Jesus Christ, Jeremy resists judging others, but humanly admits this can be difficult. He maintains some hope that no matter how bad some behave, they might see the light, regret their actions, reform, and ask for forgiveness. Being able to make people take responsibility for their bad deeds is how Jeremy believes he is following God's plan for him. Now, here in the book is where the investigation took a decided turn. Agent Chad Musias discovered that some of the basement lights had been removed, specifically from the areas where Byron was seated. Let that sit in for a second. The lights were out. It was dark, and this made it all the worse. Oh my God. Byron had deliberately let the darkness conceal him from the view of anyone coming down the stairs. Musias had also found a video surveillance recorder on the table in the back office. It seemed to be working, and with any luck, it would provide substantial evidence to support their case. But Jeremy realized he needed to find out how to access the video, and he needed to interview Byron again. Leaving Musias to continue the search, Jeremy headed to the sheriff's office, concerned that Byron may have already contacted an attorney who would likely recommend he not speak to investigators. And if he refused to speak with Jeremy, there's no way to obtain the video surveillance recording as evidence. If he engaged an attorney, Jeremy could still try to get a statement, but it was walking on eggshells. Jeremy would have to again reaffirm that Byron knew his Miranda rights, knew his attorney could be present when he was interviewed, and confirmed that Byron was waiving that right and was going to speak to him without an attorney, which is a lot of hoops to jump through. In jail, Jeremy retrieved his digital recorder and went into the intoxilizer room where they interview people currently in jail, commonly DUI cases. Get it, the intoxilizer room, right. Okay, so the master controller brought Smith to him, and Jeremy explained he had more questions turning on the recorder. He reviewed who they are, where they are, the date, the time, the location, and that this is a follow-up interview. Reviewing the Miranda warning legal rights, Byron said he recalled and he understood them, and he indicated that he would listen to questions. Had he spoken with an attorney? Yes, he had. Was Byron comfortable answering Jeremy's questions without his attorney present? Smith replied, quote, "Yes, I'm willing to talk with you even though he's not here now," end quote. Jeremy confirmed that Byron knew he had the right to have him present, and he was waiving that right. Byron confirmed that he understood, and he was, and Jeremy was greatly relieved. Jeremy asked him about the video surveillance system, and Byron said it was only partially installed. The outdoor cameras had been running for about a week, decently concealed. Did he have any cameras inside the house? He replied, no, not yet. And Jeremy asked where the monitors were located. Smith said in the basement office on a bench. Jeremy asked if the cameras were recording yesterday and learned that they all were, with this loaded onto a hard drive. Was there a password or security code to get into this? And Smith said, quote, "I've already offered to give that to anyone who wants to look at it. I consider it good verification and more accurate than the information I gave earlier," end quote. And Smith gave Jeremy the security code plus instructions on how to retrieve the information. Did Byron have a cell phone? Well, he did, but he rarely used it, so it wasn't activated. He was reluctant to go to St. Cloud to do so because he feared he'd, quote, "get raided. I haven't left town. I haven't gone shopping," end quote. He had a landline with two extensions in his house, one in the kitchen and one in the basement office. The phone in his bedroom wasn't plugged in because he hated getting woken up in his sleep. Only, he didn't really sleep anymore, fearing someone might come in and shoot him. So, Byron Smith had access to a phone. On hearing the doors rattling, seeing the shadow, before the window was broken, and then certainly afterward. Got it. Jeremy shifted to his vehicle. How many did he own? And this turns out was complicated because he didn't use all of his vehicles. He had the silver Chevy S10 pickup, a Cayenne SUV that was in his garage and used on road trips, and he had a maroon Oldsmobile Cutlass that he inherited from his mom, which was in extremely good condition with low mileage, and a 1967 Chevy Nova, which was hit by a tree. Its restoration was on hold. So Luberts asked where his Chevy 10 pickup truck was, and Smith replied, quote, "It's parked in a cul-de-sac north of my other property, which is the adjacent property to the north," end quote. Well, how far away from his house was this? Well, about a 3-minute walk, one block. Well, why was it parked there? Well, Smith was going to clean out the garage, and he wanted it out of the way. Was it parked in front of the property he owned? No, it was out of sight because he didn't want it vandalized, and he was starting to clean up on Thursday morning. And Jeremy confirmed again all this information, that he had parked it there on Thursday morning. Smith said, quote, "No, that would have been a trigger for them coming to see me. That would have been the trigger. That's why they came. They saw me drive the truck, and they didn't see me come back because I walked, and that's why they came," end quote. Well, what time did he move his vehicle? Byron said around 11 a.m., and it should be on the video. Had he parked there previously? No, he had not. He said, quote, "out of sight, out of the way, because I wanted it out of the garage, but I'm not leaving anything out where anybody can get to it," end quote. And Jeremy asked the obvious question, wasn't he concerned someone might break into it parked over there? And Smith said, quote, "they're not being raided over there. I'm being raided," end quote. But I'm not really sure that's true, because there had been a string of burglaries, not just at Smith's place. As the third interview ended, a realization seemed to occur to him. Quote, I'm shocked. I didn't ever realize that," end quote. Meaning Nick and Haley had broken in because the absence of the pickup truck indicated that no one was home. So what do you think, murder bookies? Did this just dawn on Byron or not? When Byron now returned to his cell, I will pause my storytelling here because this is about to take a vicious twist and I just cannot get into all of it right now. But in 2 weeks, episode 85, The Motherlode, on Murder on Elm Street, The True Story, will continue. And I am very excited about our next book, Levi's Eyes by Aphrodite Jones. I have long admired Miss Jones, who you may recall from her many appearances on Dateline NBC, ABC's 2020, and her ID TV series True Crime with Aphrodite Jones. I thought I was familiar with this story in Levi's Eyes, but I was wrong. The depth and breadth of what Aphrodite presents is mind-blowing, and this is on the murders of Christine and Levi Carlson, committed 17 years apart. And we hear from the killer himself and see how the threads bind these two murders and how they are exposed. I read all 382 pages in about 3 hours. So thank you for listening, Murder Bookies. I see you as you hear me. Please, please, please take a few minutes to leave an awesome review that will help me make new Murder Bookies. I really could use some new ones, so please do so right now. Share your thoughts with me at jill@murdershelfbookclub.com, on X, Facebook, Instagram, or you can join Patreon for $4 a month. New spring designs are out on Spreadshop, so get your merch. CrimeCon is coming. Links are on my blog at www.murdershelfbookclub.com with sources, photographs, show notes, diagrams, our snack recipe, and wine pairing too. Always trust your gut and lock your doors and windows. Written and produced by Jill, all rights reserved. Music by Carl Hosena and lyrics by Otto Harbach.